Welcome back to Master Wu's podcast. This is episode 6. Hope you're all doing well and keeping safe and healthy in mind, body, and spirit during social distancing. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Jonathan Chan, a rheumatologist at Vancouver General Hospital. He's been a great friend of mine who I've known since he was my roommate at boarding school all the way back in grade 7. Since I've known him, he's always been someone with a great passion for medicine and biology. So he's a terrific person to have a conversation with about the current state of COVID-19 here in British Columbia. Dr. John Chan is a graduate of the University of Alberta Medical School, completed his residency at UBC and a fellowship at the University of Toronto. He's truly a born and bred Canadian doctor. Today's episode's audio quality is much better than the last episode, although it does cut out in and out at a few times. But overall, it was great. So here it is, my interview with Dr. John Chan. Thanks for joining us, John. Oh man, I played this song because I remember how big of a crush you had on Britney Spears when she first came out, and that's all you would talk about for a little while. So I just had to use this opportunity to bring that up.
That brings back memories. Yeah.
Good times. How's How are the wife and kids? How are you holding up?
They're okay. Just adjusting to school at home is a challenge. And, I'm working in the office. My wife, Connie, she's in the office 2 days a week. And so on those days, we don't get started on the schoolwork until 5:36. And so it's a bit of a rough go. But, you know, I think everyone's struggling, so we're making do.
We're all just adjusting to this new normal, I guess. But I mean, every family's handling schoolwork differently with their kids. I have friends telling me that the projects some teachers assign are so extravagant, and they end up having to do the projects for their kids.
Oh man, yeah. I can imagine. Like, my kids are young, you know, kindergarten, grade 1, so it's not too extravagant. I'm kind of grateful for that. But I can feel bad for, you know, someone in grade 10 or whatever. I mean, it's not. You're not sufficient to do school work with just a couple questions here and there. Like, you actually got to do some work. And so, I think it's certainly tougher as the kids get older, I think.
It can be. I've got my students making a podcast for the very first time. So that's kind of why I'm making this podcast, just to have a sample for them to listen to.
Yeah.
Yeah, how long have I known you for? I think it was like since 1996 or 7.
So yeah, for 96, I think.
96 is when I met you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and our the first bonding experience.
Yeah, you welcomed me to the boarding house. You took me to wonton noodles and fried chicken wings.
Oh, I don't remember the chicken wings. I just remember the wonton noodles.
Well, I forget the name of that place. It was on Dunbar, but there was these arcade video games there that you guys like to play, and I didn't get an allowance at the time, so I wasn't allowed to play, but I would watch you guys, and the owner would get on my case saying, you can't just sit here and watch. You need to buy something. So the cheapest thing on the menu is the chicken wings. So, you know, once a week I'd buy these chicken wings, which are actually pretty good. But it was just so that I could watch you guys play Street Fighter.
Oh, wow. Such a different time. I remember playing video games in that place, and the food was just mediocre, but the entire restaurant was about that arcade machine in the back. At least for me, it was.
Yeah. Totally, yeah.
So thanks for taking time out of your busy day. I know you have a lot to work on with your practice and all. We have a lot of student listeners and hopefully a lot of different listeners tuning in. And just to get to know you a little bit, I know that you're a rheumatologist. How did you get into this field out of all the different fields? And a second part of this question is, you know, I have a lot of students that aspire to go into medicine. So when did you know you wanted to go into this, go into the field of medicine? Is my question.
Okay. Well, you know, my dad is a really good job of brainwashing. Well, you know, I think, in all fairness, he did pique my interest. So my dad's a GP, and I have a lot of family members in the medical field. And
this GP is a GP is a general family doctor. Okay.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, he would take me with him to his house calls, take me with him to the hospitals, and you know, he'd introduce me to the patients, and he'd, you know, put the stethoscope on my ears, and they'd listen to this. Can you hear the love dub? Can you hear the murmur? You know, look at this person's fake knee, and you know, and so that kind of just got my interest going. I think nowadays you're not allowed to bring your kids to see you because it's patient confidentiality, and you know, if a doctor asks
different rules in the 90s, for sure.
It's a bit of a mismatch of what would you call that?
Legislation?
Yeah, like, I mean, patients feel obliged to let their doctors do whatever, right? And so they wouldn't necessarily say no, even if they're not comfortable with a kid, you know, listening to the heart. For example.
It's a breach of trust, I guess.
There you go, yeah.
Makes sense.
So anyways, they kind of piqued my interest at a young age, and so I kind of always wanted to do medicine, and so in that, when I was in medical school, it was kind of debating between surgery and with internal medicine, and family medicine as well was something that I considered. I initially wanted to do surgery, but when you're applying, you got to apply broadly, and you can't be so fixated on one thing because, you know, life takes you in different directions, right? So my first choice was a specific type of surgery. But, you know, I knew I was happy doing a lot of other things, and I ended up getting into internal medicine. When I went into internal medicine, initially I was very interested in cardiology, and I was tried to line up some research and some electives there. But actually just a month before picking your field, so what happens is you spend some time in different fields getting a sense of what they do and if you like it. And so about a month or two before, we had to commit to, you know, make our applications for what area you wanted to do. I did a rotation in rheumatology and loved it. Part of it was, it's very interesting. It's kind of like the Sherlock. I think of it as like the Sherlock Holmes of medicine because you're often dealing with these weird and wonderful diseases that a lot of people might be scratching their heads about, and you can piece it together and come up with a diagnosis and often a good treatment plan. So that was one thing that was very appealing to me. The other thing is there's been a bit of a revolution in our therapy. So for a long time, we had these debilitating diseases where you had no treatment and you kind of just give them some Advil and some aspirin and morphine, and eventually their joints would crumble and they'd be in a wheelchair. For a lot of these autoimmune conditions. And in the last 10, 20 years, there are these new medications that have been revolutionary. And most people with rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, should live a fairly normal life on therapy. And in some cases now, we're actually able to stop therapy and keep them in remission. So that was kind of another interesting thing. And the third thing was lifestyle. You know, in medicine, oftentimes, you do have to work pretty crazy hours, and definitely in training, there's no question. It was very stressful and straining on my own personal relationships because, you know, if you're on internal medicine or ICU, you know, you're probably, you know, 80 to 100 hours is not unreasonable. And if you want to do surgery, you know, 120 hours a week for years on end is not unheard of. So it's very, very tiring. And so I knew that it wasn't for me. I wanted to do something that was meaningful, but also where I could have a work-life balance. And rheumatology is one of the few areas where there are urgencies, but very few emergencies. So I generally don't have to go into the hospital past 6 p.m. and rarely would have to go on the weekends, which is a good bonus for me.
I feel like that should be the slogan to promote rheumatology. Urgencies, but not many emergencies. And then that will just spell out that work-life balance, right?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the newer grads are seeing that work-life balance is really important. And so totally. More recently, psychology has gotten super popular. For a long time, no one would ever want to go. It is not as high paying as, you know, say, cardiology. But certainly, you know, I think it's become popular because people are realizing, you know, no matter how much money you make, if you get divorced, you know, that's a 50% cut.
Well, time is the greatest currency, I think, that society should value. And, you know, there's got to be a balance between the two things. You can't just sacrifice all your time for a higher salary or your job in general. You know, I have so many memories of you throughout high school that you were so determined to be a doctor, not just because maybe your dad wanted you to, but I think it was a genuine interest. And that's why, you know, throughout the years, I pepper you with questions about my health. So, because I know you'll answer them in the same kind of passion that you've answered my question just now. And something I don't know if I've told you, maybe I've told you in the past, but you are the biggest reason I was able to do so well on my provincial exam for biology in grade 12, because biology was one of my worst subjects. I think I fell asleep through one too many classes in grade 12. And when it came time for the provincials, you know, that's the exam that you get your final mark on and helps you get into university. I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to find John Chan because he knows everything in biology. And we just studied together. And I think just being in your presence made my biology mark go up in that month and a half. So I've got to use this opportunity to thank you for that. Because, yeah. Oh man. So, you know, we're well past a month into social distancing, trying to flatten the curve here in BC. How has this affected your practice as a doctor in seeing your patients?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think I'm very fortunate in that a lot of what we can do online. So, even before COVID-19, we were doing a lot of telehealth and video conferencing.
Oh, John.
The app we're using right now to be able to follow people. So a lot of our diagnosis and adjustment of therapy does require a good physical exam. So I need to put my hands on someone's joint to really tell. But if someone's stable, there's a lot you can do online and just looking at someone. And so we've had to transition a lot more towards that. And so 90% of what I'm doing nowadays is through video or teleconference. If someone does have an emergency, I've got to bring them into the office here. And so, you know, we do glove, gown, goggles, and everything, wear a mask. But for other areas of medicine, it's definitely put a hamper on things. So surgery, for example, is largely put on hold unless there are life-threatening cases, just because we need to use the OR rooms for ventilated patients. And so I think certainly some aspects of medicine are greatly affected. But thankfully, you know, we're definitely slowing down the progression of this condition. I think we are definitely flattening the curve. And we're seeing that the numbers, at least if not plateauing, are coming down, which is very reassuring, because I think, you know, I think Bonnie Henry's done a fantastic job. And she walks this fine line between, you know, making sure we're doing appropriate social distancing and getting adequate PPEs and sending the right message, giving hope, without being overly draconian. You know, I think a lot of physicians were super concerned, and on my Facebook and Twitter threads, it was everyone saying, you know, shut it down, lock it down, you know, give people tickets if they're walking on the street. And, you know, yes, that's true. If you did that, you would flatten the curve a little quicker. But on the other note, you don't know why someone might need to go out. Like, maybe their mom lives alone and can't get groceries. Or maybe people have psychiatric illness and they're just depressed and they need to get out, get some fresh air. And I think she's doing a great job walking that fine line, balancing, making sure we're not overly suppressing people and keeping them at home, but at the same time, preventing the spread of this illness.
Yeah, she definitely did a really great job establishing a realistic picture of what's happening with facts. And then she gives the citizens of British Columbia enough independence and autonomy in making decisions of what to do with the facts that she gave us. So everything she says is a very strong, almost a very strong suggestion. And then she put it in our hands. And I think BC responded really well, especially in comparison to a lot of other places in the world, namely the United States. But that's a whole other story with their leadership and everything and their structures.
They're struggling. But I mean, even compared to Ontario and Quebec, I think, and you know, I think they're trying their best. I think part of the issue in Quebec was they had spring break a little earlier. And so everyone went out and then came back. They had 3 days of school. And that kind of just brought the virus and spread it.
And right at this time of the podcast, we had a few audio difficulties, but we were able to recover and I was able to ask my next question. So thanks for listening. How prepared are we in British Columbia, say, for example, if things take a turn for the worse? Hate to be pessimistic, but you always want to look at worst case scenarios just in case. And how prepared are we if the numbers do go up in our hospitals?
Yeah, I mean, they do modeling to look at what's the probability of what our capacity is. You know, if this follows more like an Italy trend, like what can we handle that strain in our system versus South Korea? Thankfully, we're looking more like South Korea, definitely finding. But if we headed towards Italy, where there's just a flood of patients, then no system would be able to handle that. So the challenge is, you might read on the news that this virus kills, you know, 1 or 2% of the population. Probably actually a little bit less than that. So probably the best data is from the Diamond Princess cruises. You have an older population there, and roughly 1.2 to 1.7% of them died. So that's already a patient or a group of people who are on the older end of the spectrum, and you know, under 2% were dying. So when you look at the general population, it's going to be much less than that. The problem is, if you took, you know, 1 or 2% of the whole Canadian population and imagine they all showed up to the hospital in a span of like a month or so, there would not be enough beds. So when you look at the patients from China or from Italy, about 10 to 15% of them needed hospitalization. So you could save most of them if you give them oxygen. You know, if you're able to intubate them, then it's kind of a 50-50 chance they'll make it. But if you flood the system, then all those people you could have saved will definitely die.
Well, and just to give a perspective on the numbers, I mean, 1% of our Canadian population is about, what, 370,000 people?
Yeah.
Right? Something like that? Yeah.
You probably wouldn't get the actual, like, full population getting the illness, because you'd probably get herd immunity at around 60 to 80%. But imagine, say, 30% of the population ended up, like in New York right now, 20% of New York City, if they do blood tests, apparently has been exposed to the virus. And so you get, you know, 100,000 people showing up. And then people who have other health issues, like a heart attack, like a stroke, like a bad pneumonia, they wouldn't get any hospital. So you'd lose those people as well. And so you'd have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people dying needlessly if you didn't kind of flatten the curve. And that's the real concern. And if we can space it out, I guess the question is, what's our end game? How do we get out of this situation, right? Because a lot of people are wondering now that we flatten the curve, now what? Because if everyone goes back to work, the numbers will spike again.
But this happened in 1918 during the Spanish flu. You know, they did comparisons between Philadelphia and St. Louis, and St. Louis did a really good job of social distancing, but Philadelphia went ahead and had parades, and their numbers spiked exponentially, kind of like what New York is experiencing. But St. Louis, they flattened the curve, and then they decided, okay, it's time to just let people back out, and then they had another spike. So I feel like if how we move forward has to be super calculated.
that's no, we're kind of wandering into unknown territory. I mean, we don't really know. If you look at, for example, South Korea right now, they're almost business as usual, and they're not getting spikes. But they do have, you know, really good technology on their side. So what they do is they have, to my understanding, they can locate your phone, and if you and they can trace where you've been. So if you swab positive for COVID, they'll trace back where your GPS signal was, and then they'll signal an app on all the people who possibly were in your vicinity, and they'll self-isolate or look for symptoms. And then everyone's wearing masks, and at restaurants, everyone's social distancing. So, you know, I think it's possible to return a little bit back to normal. It wouldn't be full, you know, full normalcy, but it might be, you know, with appropriate social distancing, with appropriate aggressive screening, and with contact tracing, I think we can get people back to work at some degree. And until at least we get a vaccine or better therapy or this virus mutates or we eventually get herd immunity. But it'll take years before we get enough people infected to achieve a herd immunity. Yeah. So it's going to be a little bit of a while.
Yeah, that's the general consensus I'm hearing. And I also hear that the amount of testing that we have available is going to be a huge factor. The ability to test at a rapid pace to a mass population is going to really determine how we can allow things to start to return back to normal. Because if you don't have enough testing, then you can't really confirm your numbers going up and down at like appropriately for return.
Illness, community spread will be difficult if you don't have tests. The other challenge is we know that quite a few patients are asymptomatic, and that asymptomatic spreading is possible and probably contributing a fair amount in the community. And so, and then the swab testing is not that accurate if someone's asymptomatic. Mm-hmm. So it's estimated that the false negative rate, so you know the swab comes back negative, but you actually have the condition, is anywhere between 20-30% if you're asymptomatic. So that's going to be a challenge. And then the other question is whether or not we can do antibody testing to see if people who've passed the virus, you know, maybe they could go back to work. We're not quite there yet because we need to determine how valid the testing is, how long the immunity lasts for, and also is there a certain blood level that you need before you are actually immune? Because you know, you might have some antibodies that are detectable, but maybe that's not enough to confer actual immunity. And so eventually I think we'll get there, and probably there is some, you know, some degree of immunity that we'll be able to detect and let people go back to work for that.
You know, it's pretty interesting, you know, to study epidemiology because There's been so many different zoonotic plagues in the past or pandemics in the past. I mean, we've beaten, you know, global flus like this before and pandemics before. But I was watching a documentary and about how a virus's goal is to try to survive. And what makes this disease so unique is that it allows people to spread asymptomatically, so not having any symptoms, compared to things like Ebola or measles or smallpox, where they're quite deadly and very symptomatic. They tend to die out. That virus tends to end pretty quickly because people just die and they don't affect other people. But for this one, it's kind of a silent spreader, silent killer, and that's what's making it so rampant and scary.
Yeah, it's true. And you know, there's some theory, and whether or not I don't know how true this is, but there's some theory that most viruses tend to trend back towards more benign forms, just because that's in their best interest to keep the host alive. But I think time will tell whether or not it happens to this virus.
Time will tell. That's the message we get over and over. I mean, students ask me, other teachers ask me, when do you think we'll go back to school? Students ask me, are we going to go to camp this year? And it breaks my heart to have to answer them. You know, it doesn't seem likely, but we'll see. Time will tell. And I think we're all just in the same boat, you know. But I think this time really makes you really aware of what are the important things in life, like your health and your family, and and taking care of each other. So it does offer new perspectives, which I'm grateful for. Have you, on a personal level, have you used this time to kind of pick up new things, learn new things, maybe develop a new skill?
You know, I would say I'm busier than ever right now because I've got work and then I got to come home and be a part-time teacher. But one of my main outlets has been going to the gym, and all obviously the gym's been closed. So thankfully, one of my friends lent me a squat rack, and so I picked up a copy of Starting Strength. I don't know if you've heard it. It's a book by Mark Rippetoe, who kind of, I think he's partly attributable to starting CrossFit. So I've been reading his book and working on those lifts. So my strength is not compromised as a result.
That's awesome. That's awesome. I wish I had a squat rack to keep building the leg muscles. I'm at home doing body weight exercises and band training. I mean, it's not ideal for building strength, but it maintains, and I'm just kind of working on, you know, general cardiovascular health, which is good enough for now, I guess.
Totally. I mean, I think I have a lot of patients who definitely gain weight. They call it the COVID-19, right?
Yeah.
So people are gaining weight because they're probably snacking a lot more and not exercising as much.
Right, and that's something I've bugged my parents about a lot. They're so adamant about not going out because they want to avoid the risks of catching the virus. But what ends up happening is that they sit and watch TV for copious amounts of hours per day. And I said to them, it doesn't make sense that you're causing yourself other health risks and problems by sitting there, not exercising, in order to avoid COVID-19. You need to get out and go for walks and eat healthy, or otherwise all your efforts to avoid the virus is for nothing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
But you know how parents are more stubborn than teenagers sometimes. So
I think it's hard for a child to tell their parent what to do. Like, you know, my dad's a family physician, and he will never ask me for my opinion on arthritis. But his brother, who's also a doctor, will often ask me, and I can see my dad, he's listening, but he doesn't want to ask me my opinion.
Even though you're the specialist, you give lectures to other doctors about this stuff, it's just that barrier, that father and son, I'm not listening to you because I'm your dad barrier.
I think it's
universal for a lot of people. So I just want to ask you one final question before we kind of wrap things up. You're a healthcare worker. You hear the bangs of the pots and pans at 7 o'clock, perhaps sometimes. So definitely want to thank you for all that you do. As a healthcare worker, what final message would you want students or our listeners to know before we go?
You know, I think hang in there. We are climbing the curve. We can't let up quite yet. I think keep that positive attitude, that hope. Have patience with other people. I think, you know, Bonnie Henry's mantra of be kind and be calm, and I forget the other B, I think are definitely true, because I think when you're at home cooped up, it's easy to lose your temper. It's easy to lose your patience. And I think right now, more than ever, we need a little bit of understanding and a little bit of compassion for the people around us, and concern, and do your part and stay at home.
That's a beautiful message. I 100% agree. And you know, I think that's something everybody needs to remind themselves, not just students, you know, adults, you know, everyone that is part of this, and that's the whole world. So, you know, Dr. Chan, I really appreciate you taking time of your busy schedule to talk to us. And I think our listeners have learned a lot from you. And thanks for being you. That's what I'm trying to say.
Thanks, Tommy. My pleasure.
All right. You take care and stay safe. Stay healthy.
Same for you.
Many thanks to Dr. John Chan for joining us today, as it's always a great learning experience having a conversation with someone so genuinely passionate about medicine. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I wish you a healthy and safe rest of the week into the weekend. Till next time, you've been listening to Master Wu's podcast. Hit me, baby, one more time.